Welcome to Indie Author Answers, a podcast about the craft of writing and being an indie in the world of self-publishing. Each week, we'll read a chapter from an unpublished novel and critique it. To read along with the show, go to indieauthoranswers.com. To follow along from chapter one, go to jimheskett.com/part1. Or to get a recap of the first half of the story, go to jimheskett.com/recap. Now, let's get this mother started. So here's your host, Jim Heskett.
Oh, my beautiful peoples, welcome to Indie Author Answers episode number 42, the episode you've been waiting for since last Tuesday, and that's the truth. All right. Hey, everybody, welcome. How we doing? I'm glad you're here. I'm glad I'm here. Still alive. Yep. How is everyone out there doing? I hope well. Yeah, good. I'm glad we had this talk. So let's go ahead and actually do what we came here for and talk about indie publishing. First up, I have a little bit of news. I had a couple people send me some questions because a few episodes ago I was talking about the Five Sun Saga Omnibus Edition and how I was going to go wide with that. Well, if you search for it on the interwebs, you may notice that I did not actually go wide. It is in Kindle Unlimited, and KDP Select for now. And the reason I did that was because right about the time I was making that change is that Amazon announced their new payout for Kindle Unlimited, and I wanted to see how it would do if I stuck it in KU, and it's actually doing really well. I decided at the last minute not to go wide. I yanked it from Kobo and iTunes where I was going to publish it, and I'm going to go wide with that later, but just for now, it is doing really well on Amazon, and so the lesson I'm learning from that is that people really like omnibus editions of stuff. That book, in its first week of release, did better than the four books that make it up in all of their first month combined. The Five Sun Saga Omnibus Edition sold better. So people like omnibus editions because they're like, oh, I can get the whole thing and it's cheaper. So there's a good lesson I learned there from that. I am planning to take one of my book series wide later on this year. I'm still working on the details on that, so I don't want to say anything yet. But anyway, let's move on. Today's, or this week's, actually, since I'm not going to talk to you guys tomorrow unless you listen to this again, and then it'll still be the same thing. Anyway, this week's tip of the week is I want to talk about piracy, that big nebulous thing that a lot of us worry about. And I guess my tip is don't worry about it. One, because there's little you can do about it, because for every DMCA takedown notice you send, a pirate can just upload it somewhere else. And two, because piracy doesn't hurt sales. So the best example I like to use of this is something that Neil Gaiman said, and I thought this was absolutely brilliant. If you don't like his fiction, you should at least like his talk about when he talks about writing and publishing, because he's so fucking eloquent. He was telling a story about when he was speaking somewhere, and he asked the audience, how many of you found your favorite author by walking into a bookstore and picking up a random book from an author you'd never heard of before? And there were very few people who raised their hands. And then he said, how many of you discovered your favorite author by being lent a book from a friend? And a huge number of people raised their hands. So the idea there is every time someone pirates your book and then actually reads it, you're possibly ensuring a future fan. And the way I look at it is that people who pirate my books, they probably weren't going to buy them anyway. And maybe they really like it, and maybe they tell a friend or two, and then those people become fans. So, you know, there are pirated copies of my books available out there. I'm not like huge. You can't find me on the Pirate Bay. But I have a Google alert set up on my name, and every few days, I get an alert that it's like, download a PDF version of Wounded Animals. And I think a lot of those places don't actually have the book. They're just trying to get you to enter your email so they can spam you. But I have found actual pirated copies of my books out there. And you know what? I just can't worry about it. I don't have the time to get into the legalities of emailing those people, blah-bitty-blah. So you know what? I would rather spend that time writing, working on this podcast, and doing other stuff. So there's the lesson. Piracy, you can't really do anything about it, and it doesn't do you any good to worry, and maybe those people become future fans. So there you go. Now let's get into our reading and do that whole thing. This week we're reading Part 3, Chapter 18. It's a Brian chapter. If you remember, the last time we saw Brian, I believe, was at the bar with Alex when they went out for Alex's 21st birthday and they were trying to have a good time. And then they ended up drunkenly driving to climb a radio tower that doesn't actually exist in real life, but I needed a radio tower, so I inserted one in Boulder. And they climbed that radio tower, and Alex was drunk, and he's like, let's go to the top. And Brian didn't want to go all the way to the top, so he chickened out, and Alex yelled at Brian for being a pussy. And then they went home without speaking to each other. So now here we go with Part 3, Chapter 18, Brian. Brian scrubbed cheese from a dirty plate before placing it in the dishwasher. Alex, on the couch, had not offered to help with the dishes. His eyes were directed at the television with a bong fashioned from a used Honey Bear bottle in one hand and a lighter in the other. In front of him sat four empty beer bottles. He had been sitting paralyzed for 5 minutes or so without moving or hardly even blinking. Brian only knew Alex still drew breath by the rise and fall of his chest. Brian tossed a pointed sigh at his roommate. They had barely spoken in days. You think you can help me with the dishes or vacuum or at least do something productive? People are going to be here in an hour. What do you care, dude? It's just your dipshit friends. I don't give a fuck if our house is dirty. That's just how normal people live. I care because I want it to be clean. I met a girl a couple weeks ago and she's coming over. You may be okay with it, but I at least want her to think we got our crap together. Alex perked up at this news. Get the fuck out. You're actually bringing some trim over to our place? Yeah, I am, Brian said. You've got to be shitting me. Seriously, she's in my ethics class. Hot as hell, too. Then I wish I could be there to see it, but I'm afraid I have other... Alex trailed off as he looked around the room with childlike wonder, seemingly entangled in a world he had never seen before. Finally, he finished. Plans. That was weird. What's he on? I'm going to meet up with Kenny and then go over to Dave's, Alex said. Hey, you know what? I've been thinking lately about moving to Portland. Just seems like the place to be. Boulder sucks and I'm ready to leave. Oh, you think it's that easy? Smoking weed in the living room of an apartment in Portland is probably about the same as doing it in Boulder, Brian said. Alex pointed at the TV and started chuckling. Fucking shit, dude. Look at that guy. What guy? What are you talking about? Alex closed his eyes and emitted a low humming sound. This went on for 10 or 15 seconds, then he opened his eyes and said, Justin Ryder, that jock douchebag from the dorm. Remember when me and Kenny stuck all those pennies in his door in his dorm room and then, what do you call it? The door jam. Alex referred to what they used to call pennying back in the dorm days. Against a shut door, you pushed to create some space between the door and door jam and then crammed as many pennies in the space as would fit. When you released the door, the pennies created so much pressure against the deadbolt that it became impossible to open the door from the inside. No doubt, I remember. I had to call campus security to take down all those pennies. They had to bring the handyman. Justin was not so happy about that at all, so it's a good thing he never figured out it was you. I think he probably would have beat your ass. I'd have smacked that bitch all up and down that floor. Anyway, that dude on the TV looks like Justin. Fucking douchebag with a unibrow. Get that caterpillar off your face. Alex laughed so hard he tipped the bong and spilled some muddy brown water on his shirt. Leaning forward, he set the bong and the lighter on the table. He started to shake, his breath coming in shallow gasps. Alex, are you okay? Alex leaned back, pushing his body into the couch, his eyes rolling back in his head. Here it comes, he said as a grin washed over his face. He collapsed into a puddle as if his bones had been removed, and then he sat upright and squirmed in place, rubbing his hands up and down his chest. Now Brian understood. you're rolling after drinking all those beers? Do you know how stupid that is? Not rolling, Alex said as he began to regain his composure. He laughed as his eyelids fluttered. Candy flipping. Are you insane or just stupid? You dropped ecstasy and acid, and now you're drinking beer? Alex waved a hand over the empty bottles on the table. It's just a few dead soldiers. Never hurt anybody. I don't see what the big deal is. Don't you know that's how River Phoenix died? Nah, dude. River was on coke and heroin, Alex said in a leisurely voice. Nasty stuff, that heroin. I'd never touch it. That's for drug addicts and shit. Alex chuckled. This is not cool, Alex. Alex tried to appear composed and rational. I'm fine, Brian. Really, nothing to worry about. I feel great. Nothing to worry about. It's just a matter of getting the cocktail right, and I have totally perfected it. Brian shook his head, not wanting to discuss it further. Tonight was supposed to be about his date, not arguing with his roommate. Alex shrugged it off and dumped some yellow powder from a little packet onto the back of his hand. He raked his face across it, snorting up the dust. Brian threw the sponge on the floor. Meth, too? What the hell is wrong with you? Are you trying to kill yourself? Why don't you mind your own business, dude? Christ, it's just a little powder. I told you I'm fine. I thought you were busy getting ready for your new girlfriend anyway. Despite his wish to be non-confrontational, Brian had reached his limit. I've had this whole conversation before. I'm not going through it with you, too. Going through what? Letting me have a good time? I know how to handle my shit. I'm not an amateur. You don't need to watch over me. Alex got to his feet, swaying back and forth, and made a slow, uneven march toward the bathroom. Brian's cell phone rang just as a screech followed by several metallic plink sounds came from the bathroom. Brian had to choose between answering the phone and checking on Alex, and Brian grudgingly decided to let Alex be for now. Hello? This is Brian. I got your number from Charlie. He told me you know where to hook on some GoFast. Who is this? How did you get my number? Sorry, bro. This is Tim. I got your number from Charlie. He's friends with Derek Wiles. You know me. We had English Comp 1 class together freshman year. It's Tim. Brian did not remember Tim from Comp 1 class, but Wiles often sent random people his way. Yeah, Tim, he said. It's not really a good time right now, but I'm guessing you called me to get something. What do you need? Just a 16th, no big deal. Okay, Tim, meet me at the east end of the parking lot of NCAR in 20 minutes. I'll be in a Honda Prelude. Don't be late because I have somewhere to be after that. You know where NCAR is, right? The Weather Research Building complex thing at the end of Table Mesa Street? Yep, that one, Brian said. No problem, bro. I'll be there. Brian hung up the phone while Alex meandered out of the bathroom as though nothing had happened. He wiped his hands on his jeans and announced, "Thank God for that shower curtain. I almost fell on my ass. Well, I got some shit to do, so I'm going to get out of here. If you actually bang this super hot ethics class girl, be sure to tell me about it later. Pictures would be better, though." "Alex, come on. Don't be stupid. You can't drive. You can barely stand up straight." Alex waved a sluggish hand through the air. "Whatever, I'm okay. I don't know how many times I have to tell you. Now where are my keys?" He surveyed the room, as did Brian. The keys sat atop the TV, and they both detected them at the same time. Brian looked at Alex, who appeared tentative, as if anticipating Brian's next move. Although Brian was closer to the keys, he had no desire to engage in some Wild West showdown. He opened his mouth with the intention of trying again to reason with Alex, but before he could say anything, Alex made a mad dash toward the television. He bumped into the couch, throwing him off course, and so Brian seized the opportunity. He ran through the kitchen archway to the living room, cutting Alex off and snatching the keys. He extended his arm high, holding the keys out of reach like a child playing keep away. Alex balled his fists. "Damn it, man, think about this," Brian said. "Have somebody come pick you up if you need to go. You don't need to be driving right now. Or I'll drop you off anywhere you want. I have to go run an errand in a minute anyway. I'm not going to stand in your shadow anymore." "What does that mean, my shadow? That doesn't make any sense." Alex pushed Brian in the chest, knocking him back into the wall, and the impact forced Brian to drop the keys. Alex swiped them and leapt back out of Brian's range. Off balance, he fell backwards to the floor but then raised the keys in victory. Brian pushed himself back up against the wall, panting. "Please, don't do this. It's a terrible idea." Alex pocketed the keys and pulled his sagging jeans up onto his increasingly slim hips. "You don't tell me what to do anymore," he said, and slammed the door behind him. All right. That's part 3, chapter 18. Brian having an argument with Alex in the apartment. And while you can't really deny that there's a little too much dialogue going on there, and it's not always clear who's speaking because they don't sound very different, I think this chapter is actually not too bad. At least the ending of it is pretty good. There's some excitement there, some good conflict. If you think about it like this, of the multiple story arcs within The Problematic Virtue, one of the main plot threads is the relationship between Brian and Alex. And if we could plot points on a course, we see that in all of part one, Alex is learning from Brian. And then starting from part three on, which is where the book actually really starts, we see first when they're moving in together, they're arguing about how to get the couch up the stairs. If you remember that from like 3 months ago, they're arguing about how to get the couch up the stairs. Then Alex is berating Brian because he won't climb to the top of the tower. And now we have things have taken a serious turn, or not necessarily turn because it's kind of predictable, but things have leapt forward considerably in their story arc. Because now they've actually come to blows. At the end of this chapter, Alex pushes Brian and makes some veiled threats about, I'm not going to stand in your shadow, you don't tell me what to do, that kind of thing. So we can see that Alex has changed a lot. Meanwhile, Brian hasn't really changed very much. It's Alex who does the changing. And so, you know, from that respect, Alex is really kind of the tragic hero of this book because he's the one with the real story arc. Brian is just sort of there to observe things, and that's part of the reason why he's so boring. But I've talked before about how part one is essentially, you know, where part one is all about Alex's freshman year at school and how Brian becomes his mentor and they're developing their relationship and Alex is starting to do drugs. I've talked before about how part one is really unnecessary, but in some ways, how much time I devoted to setting up their relationship makes the fact that Alex is severely distancing himself from Brian all that much more conflict-ridden. Now, I definitely could have shortened part one and, you know, made it a lot more impactful by just choosing a few key scenes to demonstrate the beginning of Alex and Brian's relationship instead of devoting, you know, like 80 or 90 pages of the book to it. But so from that respect, it does make this all the more tragic that they're distancing, that they're growing apart from each other because they were so close at one point. But I should throw in a cautionary word about the long payoff, about the long game. You have to be careful with that because, you know, you may insert something that takes place over a long period of word count in your book because the payoff is amazing later. But if your long buildup is too boring, your readers are never going to get to the payoff. So be careful there. That's the kind of thing that your beta readers are going to notice. To be like, yeah, it was great once I got to page 250, but those first 150 pages of setup were hard to slog through. Anyway, let's go back through it line by line. So what we have here in the beginning is Brian's doing domestic stuff. We start in media res. Brian scrubbed cheese from a dirty plate before placing it in the dishwasher. Now, this is actually pretty good in media res because we know if he's scrubbing cheese, he's probably in the kitchen and he puts it in the dishwasher. So we know he's at his own apartment. So we don't necessarily need to say Brian stood in his kitchen in front of his dishwasher in his apartment scrubbing cheese from a dirty plate. The way that sentence is constructed and the key phrases, the plate and the dishwasher, we get a sense of where he is. We wouldn't assume that he's scrubbing cheese from a dirty plate in a Mexican restaurant in Denver, because that would be strange. So we assume that he's in his apartment and it works there. And then the next sentence, we know that Alex is also there with him. Alex is on the couch. Now, a bit about choreography here. This apartment is based on an apartment I lived in. And now, like when I'm writing this or when I was writing this, you know, several years ago, I had this apartment very firmly in my mind. And so it was easy for me to visualize. And I described this apartment. If you remember at the beginning of part three when they moved in, I talked at length in the text about how the apartment was laid out, and that there was an that the kitchen had a big window cutout with the, what do you call those things? I don't know. But the kitchen is an open kitchen, and then it overlooked the living room. But from the way this is described here, if you don't remember that, you might think that the couch is in the kitchen, which would be kind of strange. So I don't know what apartment you're envisioning when you hear me read this, but it may be something completely different than what I envisioned. And so that's something you have to keep in mind. If you're ever trying to describe complex choreography or vague choreography where you don't know exactly where people are, you need to be careful. And especially in this instance, because at the end of this chapter, where Alex and Brian are in relation to things in the apartment becomes very important when they're both struggling to find the keys. Now, if it was just Brian and Alex sitting in the apartment talking, it wouldn't really matter what the layout of the apartment was. But because they move around and interact with things in the apartment, that ends up being kind of important and probably confusing for a reader. So while Brian is cleaning up the apartment, Alex is watching TV, and this was based on in that apartment that I lived in. I had a roommate who smoked a lot of weed, and so this is sort of a description of him. What he would smoke a couple bowls, and then he would just get that like stoned paralyzed, where he would sit there with the lighter in one hand and the bong in the other hand, just kind of like zoning out for 5 minutes. So that's what I was trying to describe. Alex is really baked. He's got beer bottles in front of him. And so Brian is annoyed, and we know that because it said Brian tossed a pointed sigh at his roommate. They had barely spoken in days. And then he says, "Do you think you can help me with the dishes? Because people are coming over." And so if you notice throughout this book, we've already had two significant parties. We've had the party in part one at Miguel's house, where we introduced a lot of characters to the reader. Then the second party was at the beginning of part three, where we introduced Brian and Alex to the world. Well, no, that doesn't even make any sense. So the second party wasn't quite as pivotal in the plot, but that's when Brian learned that Alex and Wiles were more involved than he thought, because when they were at the construction equipment, he saw them. And now we're getting ready to move on to a third party. This is the pre-party, where we know that from a little bit later, it's not Megan's name is never said, but we know that Megan is coming over because Brian talks about how a girl's coming over. Now, we can't use Megan's name in this chapter because, as you can probably guess, Brian and Megan are going to hook up, and that's going to cause some drama. Since Alex knows Megan, if Alex knew she was coming over, that would impact things. But so at this point, Brian doesn't use her name, and if we remember, when they were at the bar a couple chapters ago, Brian didn't tell Alex about Megan, because if he had, Alex would have been like, "No, that's fucking Wiles' sister-in-law. You can't fuck her." And so when Brian's like, "Help me do the dishes," and Alex is like, "No, I don't care. It's just your dipshit friends." This chapter has a lot to do with that roommate that I had back in college. He and I would only clean up our apartment if people were coming over. Like, we lived, you know, in filth. We're college kids. What do you want? We lived in filth most of the time, but then whenever we had people over, like, we would make our apartment immaculate and spend all day cleaning it. But so we see the difference between Brian and Alex here. Alex is drunk. He doesn't care about living in filth. And Brian's like, "We at least got to make it, you know, look nice because people are coming over." And he wants this girl, who's Megan, to think that he's got his crap together. So there's very brief discussion of the girl that's coming over. Like, Alex is surprised because he thinks of Brian as this unsocial loser, which is, you know, a stark contrast to how Alex viewed Brian in part one. You know, in part one of the book, Alex viewed Brian as this super cool guy who'd done, you know, all these things, like have a threesome and had experimented with all these drugs Alex had barely even heard of. And now Alex is amazed that Brian is even talking to a girl. And then we quickly shift from there to the rest of the chapter focusing on how messed up Alex is. there's this strange line in here about, you know, I'm trying to demonstrate that Alex is really scattered when he's talking about how he's got to go over to Dave's house. And he's like, I've been thinking about moving to Portland. And so it's just supposed to be random and out of the way. And then there's a line, Brian says, smoking weed in an apartment in Portland is the same as doing it in Boulder, which I really like that line because I actually said that to someone once a long time ago. Then we have this strange segue into talking about this guy named Justin Reeder, writer, whatever, R-E-I-D-E-R, when they talk about pennying his door. And we even have a whole paragraph describing what pennying is, which feels really awkward. I mean, I know I've seen a lot of authors do this, especially in fantasy books, where they will make a reference to some kind of vernacular word, and then there's a paragraph explaining, like, it's like Brandon Sanderson does this in his books, I think, where it's like, use the flibberjabber, and then there's a paragraph explaining how the flibberjabber magic works. And I don't think Brandon Sanderson actually called anything flibberjabber, so don't hold me to that. Anyway, so we have this paragraph about what pennying is, and don't try this at home, kids, but yeah, it's a way you can seal somebody's door shut by inserting pennies between the door and the door jamb, kind of like it's like a camp prank kind of thing. But the fact that it takes time out of the story here to explain what it is feels really weird. And we could have accomplished most of that same stuff probably with just dialogue between Alex and Brian talking about the aftermath of what pennying Justin Reeder's door did to everybody. Or they really probably could have just taken that paragraph out, because after there's that exposition paragraph explaining what it is, Brian says, no doubt I remember I had to call campus security down to take out all those pennies. They had to bring the handyman. You probably could have figured out the gist that it was a prank and it involved pennies in the door, which probably would have been enough. So I, you know, that's a darling I probably should have killed there, cutting out that whole paragraph explaining what pennying is. Anyway, let's move on. Then we start to see, so we've seen Alex in that stoned paralysis, and then so we start to see just how messed up he is, because he leans back, his eyes roll into his head, and he collapses into a puddle. He's rubbing his hands up and down his chest because he's on ecstasy, and Brian is like, you are rolling, which is vernacular for being on ecstasy, if you didn't know. And Brian is mad because Alex is drinking and he's on ecstasy, which, if you've ever done MDMA, you know that drinking alcohol on it is a big, big no-no. Even ecstasy kids will tell you that you shouldn't drink alcohol when you're on ecstasy. It's just a bad idea. Anyway, so Alex is not rolling. He's candy flipping, which is more drug lingo. Candy flipping is when you drop acid and ecstasy at the same time. If you've ever done it, it is batshit insane, and I would not recommend it for anybody. A little quick side story. I did candy flip once, and it was the closest I ever came to death. I've been sober a long time now. It's just a little bit about me. But yeah, if you ever drop acid and ecstasy at the same time, you are in for a rough, rough night, my friends. Anyway, moving on. So there's discussion about River Phoenix. If you remember, this takes place in 2003, and I think he'd only been dead for a couple of years then. And then Alex says this line that's kind of funny, where he says, you know, heroin's for drug addicts. Alex does some meth, so he's even fucking crazier. He's just mixing all this crazy cocktail of drugs. And Brian still, like, Brian throws the dish sponge on the floor. That's how mad he is. And we have this strange line here that kind of seems from out of nowhere. That's a reference that most people wouldn't get. It's Brian says, I've had this whole conversation before, and I'm not going through it with you too. Now, do you know who he's talking about, who he had this conversation with before? It's his little brother, Jimmy, the one who's been missing forever. Now, if you remember way back when, Brian got mad at Jimmy because Jimmy was into meth. And when Brian found this out, they had a big argument, and it was a couple days later that Jimmy took off. And so that was part of the reason why Brian felt so guilty about Jimmy leaving, was because they didn't leave things well. But anyway, that's the kind of thing, like, it might have been helpful to reference Jimmy there to remind the reader what's going on, but we don't. So the line just kind of feels like out of nowhere. Alex storms off, And Brian's phone rings, and this guy calls up. We get a lot of names here. This is Brian. I got a number from Charlie. This is Tim. He's friend with Derek Wiles. So we get all these unnecessary names right here. But Tim wants to buy some meth, so Brian knows that he's got to leave. So the thing that what I'm trying to set up here is that Brian had to choose between going to the bathroom to check on Alex and answering this phone call to sell some meth. So Brian says he's going to go meet Tim at NCAR. Then Alex comes back in and he says, thank God for the shower curtain. Because if you remember, Alex walked into the bathroom and there was a screech and plink, plink, plink. And that was the shower curtain, what do you call the little circular things that hold the shower curtain onto the rod? I don't even know. Alex comes out of the bathroom and he's like, I gotta go. And now we get to the real meat of the chapter in the last like 15% where Brian's like, you can't drive. And Alex is like, where are my keys? I'm fine. And then, so they have this sort of like, there's a lot of overwriting here. The keys sat on top of the TV and they both detected them at the same time. Brian looked at Alex, who appeared tentative as if anticipating Brian's next move. I talked about this before about when you're in one POV, one character's POV, try not to write that character assuming what other characters are thinking. Because if we that whole thing there, Brian looked at Alex, who pretended as if anticipating Brian's next move, could have been accomplished by just writing, Brian stared at Alex, Alex narrowed his eyes and hunkered down a few inches. You know, that would accomplish the same thing. And then we know that Alex is getting ready and watching Brian just by him saying he narrowed his eyes. So then Alex makes a mad dash for the keys, and so does Brian. And now this is where the choreography comes into play, because it's confusing because we knew the whole time Brian had been in the kitchen. Alex came out of the bathroom and back into the living room. So in my head, I'm seeing the apartment, and I know that getting from the kitchen to the living room is two steps. But whatever apartment the reader is envisioning, the kitchen may be, you know, through a door or whatever, far away from the living room. So it doesn't really make sense. It would have been better if, while they're having this argument after Alex comes out of the bathroom, to describe Brian going into the living room and then describing exactly where he was in relation to Alex. That would have made the choreography a lot more simple. So Alex tries to get the keys. He bumps into the couch and Brian grabs them first and he plays keep away. And now they have their actual fight. Alex says this line about not going to stand in your shadow. And now we understand how Alex feels about the way Brian has been treating him. You know, in part one, Alex was appreciative of the way Brian mentored him. And now Alex feels like he's being squeezed, that he's in Brian's shadow, and that Alex feels like he's bigger than that, like he's better. But Brian doesn't get that. He's like, what do you mean, my shadow? That doesn't make sense. And then Alex actually pushes Brian, and it's a little tiny bit of overwriting here where it says Alex pushed Brian in the chest. That's like saying protagonist put shoes on her feet, or she put a ring on her finger. Like, you don't need to say she put a shoe on her foot, because you don't really put a shoe on anywhere else. You know what I mean? Like, you don't need to write, I put the hat on my head. Where else are you going to put the hat? On your knee? Anyway. Alex snatches the keys, and we get the cliffhanger. Not the cliffhanger, but the big moment at the end where Alex says, you don't tell me what to do anymore. And so that is, we've seen there's officially Alex is rebelling and pulling away from Brian. And then there's one other line I'd like to point out here, one of the little phrase where Alex pocketed the keys and pulled his sagging jeans up onto his increasingly slim hips. One is that in 2003, people still wore baggy jeans. They didn't have all this skinny shit that all the kids wear today. And that his hips are increasingly slim. So we've been trying to demonstrate, you know, Alex is into meth, he's been losing weight. But that kind of thing probably should have been mentioned earlier in the chapter, so we could have gotten a picture of it. Because now it would have been helpful to see, you know, like for Brian to look at Alex when he was in that stoned paralysis and, you know, maybe note how Alex's cheeks were more sunken in, or that the bags around his eyes, we could start to see the meth effect that's had on him. So anyway, that's really all I have to say about this chapter, and that's all I have to say today, this week, until next Tuesday when you guys come back for more. All right? Thanks for playing. I love you guys. I'll see you soon. Bye.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. I know, but don't be sad. We will be back. Please, don't forget to rate and review the show on iTunes and Stitcher or wherever else you happen to have found it. I mean, wherever it was, they're obviously got good taste. So please rate and review it anyway. Also, we'd like you to check out our blog at indieauthoranswers.com. You can also, I mean, if you're up for it and you've got time, pop on over to jimheskett.com and you can even sign up for the email list and you'll get free stuff. I mean, who doesn't like free stuff, right? Of course you do. So go on, you can do that as well. By the way, don't forget, you can also follow us on Twitter at IndieAnswers. And you can like our Facebook page. And if you've still got time for that, then obviously you haven't got much time left for writing. And let's face it, that's what this is about in the end. So once you've done all that, why not go out there and write something? I mean, it's what Jim wants you to do. And if Jim wants you to do it, then you should really do it.